Derek Kerr, I work out of the Microsoft Technology Center out of Toronto, Canada. I specifically focus on Exchange, Link, and Office 365 because we are a cloud-first company, which is always important for cloud. And here I have Mike. Please, go ahead.
Sure. Mike Havrish, part of the global worldwide team. I focus on the telcos, and we are currently working hard with them, enabling their on-prem solution as well as our customer solutions and also the hosting solutions all the way through.
So as I was mentioning as we go around, it was very interesting trying to build a security session at a level 200. For those that are security certified, I apologize. Probably 80% of what we're going to talk about today you already know about. So if that's the case, please take the opportunity to go see another session. I want to make sure we level set this. I don't want any mis expectations here. So session objectives today, which we're going to try to cover. Everything about Link, the objective here, we want you to understand the security, the baseline, and that really Link is secure out of the box, and we're going to go through some of those concepts at first. Then we'll level set some terminology, and then we'll get into edge, reverse proxy, and securing beyond Link. We're going to go through some of the basics of Link encryption, NAT transversal, out-of-the-box safety capabilities that are built into Link. We're going to go to the perimeter as well, talk about some of the best practices that we've seen from the field, specifically some of the POCs and the architecture and design that I've done to date with some large clients, what we see, the good, the bad, and the ugly as well. And then finally, we're going to get into some of our partner ecosystem. Really, Link is a component, but you have to understand that there's a lot of security and considerations that you need to think about beyond Link, and we're going to touch on those as well today. Anything you want to say?
Nope. It's good. Cover all the way through.
Right on. It's always nice when your colleague says you got it on.
Yep. We are both Canadian. We're from Toronto, by the way, and so we sometimes say A, so please don't knock us for that as we present.
A? Right on. And A is also a reference. Actually, A is a verb, too. We won't get into our Canadian dictionary. So we're going to get into the introduction to Link security. We'll talk about some concepts, some things that I want you to understand, and just try to engage you and start thinking about what security is. We're even going to have a little history lesson. Hey, we're going to talk about some Caesar cipher. We'll talk about the Enigma machine for that matter as well. Hey, why not? This is where security came from. I think a lot of people forget that decryption was actually started in the 1700s, right? We'll touch on that. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag. We'll talk about out-of-the-box Link security. What's in there out-of-the-box? As painful as it may be to some people when we look at previous versions of deployment of the UC stack, Link 2013 really forces you to understand your deployment before you hit go. And we're going to go through that process as well and why we did that as opposed to some of the precursor technologies that we've released. We're going to talk about some foundational security technologies. Yes, we're going to talk about NAT, if you don't know what NAT is. We're going to talk about ICE Stun and Turn. I do want a level set because it is a 200-level course. I don't want to confuse those, and those that are security people, might be a time to text message, those types of things. Just keep the noise down. Also, I hear it's a good time to unwrap that candy wrapper now and pop it into your mouth, please. We're going to get into the edge server, some of best practices, common edge deployments. We're going to go over three, the what, the why, the where typically people go wrong, especially when they've been moving from one VoIP provider to Link, and we'll just leave it at that. Also, we're going to get into some reverse proxy considerations. We'll go through the three that are listed on the interop site and also call out one that isn't listed but works fairly well, and I can't believe I just said that. And finally, we're going to talk about securing beyond Link, some threat scenarios that we should be considering. You know, if you've got SIBtrunk, PSTN, other methods of connection, those aren't Link. Those are beyond Link. And they still need to be considered as part of your security footprint and your requirements.
Good. Let's go.
Oh, this is easy. So, security frameworks. Hey, there's so many of them. I actually was thinking about putting several of them into the slide, and I thought, wow, let's just talk about one. So, do we have any CISSPs in the audience? We shall raise a hand if you are.
No.
Good, you don't have to leave the room then, because otherwise you'd be bored. So this is conceptually the framework that most people utilize in order to consider security. Very high level, you don't need to memorize it. The deck is available for you to download at a later time, but really trying to understand some of these considerations like access control, right? And I would like you to consider access control also more so on the fact of physical security. This is the one that baffles me. How many people do not consider the physical security of their infrastructure? And I'm not talking about keys, firewall, ports. I'm talking about, is your root certificate authority online and reachable? Did you generate the key and put it into your intermediate and then take it offline? Right? Are you doing some fundamental considerations which are way before you even consider about deploying Link? Because as you'll see as we go through, certificates is a very integral part of Link. So very high level, this is it. Again, we're going to cover about 80% of this, and we'll get into a little bit more depth as we go on. I have to tell you, this was the hardest thing I did in my life. Visio is painful. And doing a three-dimensional representation of a basic deployment, my content track owner, Barry Castle, God bless him. You know, he put in a good 17 hours with me getting my head wrapped around how to actually present an idea visually. As I'm used to talking, you know, level 3, level 400. I'm used to talking technical considerations where you already know what I'm saying. So from a very high level, bottom left to top right. If I'm Pacer, I'm sorry, I tend to favor the left, my left, I apologize. Out here we have our external connections, so we have our federation, Skype, for instance, our remote users, mobility clients, session border controllers, branch offices, what have you, other IPPBXs, for instance, these types of things. Then we have our edge firewall into our perimeter, edge server, reverse proxy, SPC gateway, load balancer, very simplistic pieces. I'm sorry I didn't draw the little arrows and that type of stuff. I'm sure you guys can figure it out. We're all somewhat networking savvy. Back-end firewall, and then what typically do we see with inside the organization? So we have lots of little endpoints over here, which we'll go through. Basic Link core deployment, right? We've got our director, which we tell you not to do, but we'll cover why you may want to consider a director in your organization. Persistent chat server, nice little Link server. Our back-end services, you know, we've got our Exchange, SharePoint database, and WAC server. I'm probably dating myself. I should be saying Office Web App server, as well as some Link endpoints. So let's kind of go through and consider some of these ideas here first before we get into depth. BYOD. Who does it scare here? Scares the hell out of me. But the financial benefits of BYOD are something that we cannot turn away from, right? And I don't know about you, you know, this is my third phone in a year. If I had corporation pay for this, it wouldn't happen. You know, I drop, I crack the plates too much, those types of things. So there's a real cost benefit here. But with BYOD, it's really changed that security landscape. How do we manage it? How do we secure a device we don't own and can't 100% own, right? People have their lives on it, their pictures. Their whole world is on these mobile devices. If it's lost because of some email, or, you know, I leave the organization and you wipe my whole next 6 years of my life, I'm going to be pretty upset, right? So BYOD is something that we deal with quite often at the MTC, whether it be Link or MDM solutions and how to properly manage it and segregate corporate from personal lives. But you really need to understand how does this work? So one thing that Microsoft did is we own level one client development now. We're not... You know, there's lots of other companies out there that might develop clients. But what I want you to consider here is that because we develop the back end, we probably have a pretty good idea of how to develop a secure client to work with that back end, rather than a third-party guy that's been writing code, hacking a couple pieces together, and it manages to connect and pull some video down. But how secure is it? You know, we consider some of these other mobile operating systems and the fragmentation that's occurred. It took us a long time to get some of our client out to the Android marketplace because of that fragmentation, because of those security considerations and how many flavors there are.
Yeah. Just to add to that, forensic security. Anyone heard of this term? What that means is anything with a hard drive, a phone, a computer, you think you've erased it, you haven't. There are the tools out there. There are specialists that can retrieve that. We came from Toronto. We have a famous mayor. He's now international.
Who knows our mayor? Hey, Rob Ford, let's go party.
He went out to the public and he said, there's no video of me smoking crack. What happened is it was erased on a hard drive. Forensically, they retrieved that and they proved that the video was there.
I used to actually work for forensics. I used to, with the provincial and federal courts, I used to go after pedophiles, right? I used to actually go into libraries and anyway, that's a topic for another conversation.
So the one way around it is Link, your information that you're using with Link stays within the application itself. It's not touching your hard drive, whether that's a computer, whether that's a cell phone as you go through that. So realize that. But this is a real risk today. You think your data is erased with your applications, it usually is not, and it can be retrieved.
Physical access, again, this is probably the number one overlooked thing with any security, and we all know it, you know, a locked door, a phone, a workstation, you know, without a timeout and the person didn't hit the, you know, the Windows L key and walked away. I've got Link, I've got phone, I can sit down in front of it and I can be somebody else. Paramount is controlling physical access to these types of infrastructures and understanding that if you don't have physical security, everything that's built on top of it is useless. You need those foundation building blocks to feel safe and secure with your environments. Makes sense, right? Why is it that most people don't practice it? How many people have a PIN on their phone? Unless, of course, it's hooked up to Exchange and you're being forced to do it because, you know, you've got an administrator that's saying, do it. Most people don't. Look at certain cell phone vendors out there until a recent update didn't even require you to have a PIN. It was just a swipe to the right, right? That type of access is very important, and most people overlook it. How important is your meetings, right? You know, we always talk about being a fly on the wall. Maybe you're having a conversation about a corporate takeover, or you know, for even more so, if I had call detail records and I started seeing the CEO of company A was calling B 9 times in a day, I can start building some analysis and some trending into that. And I can think beyond what's just physically there and make some assumptions. Probably make a lot of money off of it too. So very important is I'm not trying to, well, maybe I am trying to scare you. I'm trying to just get you to think about the very simple things that most people are forgetting in any type of environment, whether it be Link, whether it be Exchange, whether it be SharePoint, governance, little g, gotta be important.
A lot of people, a lot of the questions we see with Link is, you're using Wi-Fi remotely for your Link calls. Is it secure? Well, we'll address this later on. The other issue we see a lot of times is, yeah, we're federating with another company. Is that call secure? Because you're using the internet for that federating all the way through. Are those texts being intercepted? We'll address that as well too. We do use encryption and we'll talk about that today.
Again, before Link, physical security, workstation, Active Directory is the authoritative source, right? GPO, lockout policies. NTLM, gotta love that, right? Three lockouts. All of a sudden I've locked out a service account or I've taken a whole infrastructure offline. These are fundamental building blocks to any secure infrastructure, and most people are not considering these aspects of it. Very important. Again, as my colleague called out, you know, as you're exchanging information with your business parties, what type of information are you exchanging? Is it secure? Is it all or nothing, for instance, as most of us think it is, and we'll touch on that a little later when we talk about securing beyond Link and some of the considerations that you can start thinking about rather than just turning federation on and off, which most people only think is capable of doing right now. Finally, when we think of standards, this implies security, right? If it's a standard ratified, we all feel good about it. There's not 16 versions of the truth. And we can all come to a common belief and understanding. And we're going to build on those principles with Inside Link as we go through the out-of-the-box security capabilities. So, out of the box, Link, secure by design. Woohoo! All communications are secure by default. You need to break Link if you want to make it like other vendors out there. SRTP we use. TLS, MTLS for all our communication requirements. ICE, done in turn for our transversal media signaling access proxy capabilities through the edge interface. All inner server communication outside of Link, we're using OAuth now based on certificates in order to go from Link to Exchange, pull that contact card, pull the high definition photo, these types of capabilities. But it's secure by design, and it's secure out of the box. It can be somewhat challenging to set up at front, again, because it forces you to think instead of just hitting next, 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 which many of us do by default because this is how it's been for so long. But you need to consider those foundational requirements.
Yep. Just to add to that, what's unique about Link and the UC solution in its space itself is we use certificates. The competition doesn't. What the competition does use is VPN. VPN, especially for voice traffic on data lines, adds an extra payload on top of the data stream. What does that mean? That means when you get onto the limit of what voice is, degradation of services happens that much quicker because you have extra data transversing across.
Has anybody done a phone call via VPN? I will get on that. That's
painful.
Least privileged security by design, right? You've seen this. This doesn't just need to be Link. This is a concept that Microsoft's been doing for a long time with our vector testing. You know, we've opened up our security cyber center down in Redmond. If you haven't seen it, wow, what an investment. What a pretty, pretty place. We'll leave it at that. No users are admin by default. You need to add them out of the box. So everything is restrictive. And you start building out from there based on your requirements for security, right? Security is paramount. Again, no accounts are enabled by default. That's pretty much given. But again, not necessarily the case with some of our competitors. All external access is disabled by default. We publish it out. Federation, lookup, mobility, external access, PIC, whatever you want to call it, public IM connectivity services. All off. You either decide whether this is beneficial to your organization or not, you wrap it up, wrap it down, and whatever your company is comfortable with from a security standpoint, this is what typically drives and tells us what we're going to deploy and how we're going to leverage it.
Yeah, absolutely. On federating, for example, some organizations open up federating to federate with as all the companies, or you can control that list and just do the domains you like, 1, 2, 3, ABC. That's based on your control with your security policy team.
Government, closed. Public, yep. It depends, right?
Exactly.
Hardware devices such as phone, right? We all require hardware pins, credential logins. You're not just plugging it in, getting it, and having service. There's a requirement for authorization and authentication with inside the Link stack by design. So, certificates. I have to say that certificates are probably the place that I look at first when I get into a Link environment that's not working. Any of you agree? Right? It's integral. So let's just think about where certificates are used. And I'm glad people raised their hands. I delivered a session like this, and everybody thought, certificates, what's that? That's great. You're all Link gurus. So we use certificates on the edge server. We use it in the reverse proxy. We use it in the load balancer. You should be using it in your session border controller. I hope you're using SRTP. Our Link servers are using it, right? Our front end, our director, our persistent chat. We're using OAuth for communications to the back end infrastructure. Mind you, I did not highlight SQL. Good thing we didn't circle that one. And then our endpoints, all using certificate, right? TLS DSK is a method of authentication without firing out those credentials after you've logged in once. What a great idea, authenticating based on a certificate. What happens when certificates fail? The whole infrastructure goes down, right? How often has a certificate expired and all of a sudden your federation route isn't working, or you know, you get the calls and you know, my clock isn't set right, or you know, some bizarre answer is given to you. The more bizarre the answer, the more quicker you should realize it's a certificate issue. That's what I've come to realize. So, enterprise certificate root authority, right? Root, not route. generate it, get that intermediate certificate up, pass that puppy down, and get that root certificate offline. Don't just, you know, I still like the old NT ways. Tuck it in a closet and just check it every once in a while. Make sure it's up to date, not online, take them off, plug them in. But it is the gatekeeper of security and link. So treat it as such. You keep looking at your watch. You're making me nervous. Are you secure?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. So let's consider this, right? So certificates are a big part of the PKI infrastructure with InsideLink. We have server-to-server authentication, MTLS. We use OAuth as our method for authorization and authentication for communications beyond link. Examples, unified contact store, high-definition photos, those types of things. And I wanted to call out this because I was surprised how many people don't realize this is on the radar, right? Does everybody know that this is coming? Private names, dot local, anything that cannot be publicly resolved by your CA will not be issued. You can't do it, right? And I don't want to misconstrue this. I'm saying private names, no private IP address and DNS names. Really, you know, if you've done a PAT or a NAT or you're publishing a web server, it's reachable. You've got a public IP that's hitting it. But it must be accessible and verifiable by your certificate authority. This is a change because we shouldn't have been doing it in the first place. Public CA should not have been generating internal certificates for things that we don't know about. How can that be secure? I can say, hey, Bob's my uncle, and get a certificate for that, and it's just trusted. That doesn't make any sense. Very important to realize that this change is coming. If you don't have an internal CA out there, get it deployed. Get that fixed before it's going to bite you in the butt.
One of the things this will do is it'll push towards IP version 6. We've all heard of it. It's been a slow adoption. The IP address space today is near depletion.
No, it's depleted in 2011, May 2011, actually. The whole pool depletion and the regional depletion happened about 6 months after that. So Technically, you know, we are out of IPv4 addresses.
Yeah.
Right. That announcement was made by IANA a long time ago. In 2011.
And unfortunately, this will push it forward for IP version 6, which will mean a reinfrastructure, a big project around that, just to let everyone know. That's coming, and this will be a driver for that.
So, you know, link front-end server, communicate, everything's secure, front-end to exchange. We have a OAuth that we're using as a trusted source, that third-party intermediate that we both agree on that we're going to utilize in order to securely communicate with that certificate. But the OAuth is the trusted third party in this type of a deployment. So I wanted to walk through link here, because again, I said, you know, the next concept needs to stop. So, you know, what are some key considerations when we talk about building out link and securing it? The planning tool. Does anybody use the planning tool here? You love that little Visio pop-out that it gives you? Pretty little picture. That's great for us technology folks, right? God, I hate Visio. Sorry. I know I'm going to get beat by the product group on that one. Planning tool, very important. Topology builder, right? You need to know all those pieces before you're getting anything up and running. You need to understand how they communicate. What's the important processes? Where's my SQL? Where's my front end? Am I deploying the edge? All those pieces are very important before we even validate, publish to CMS, and replicate out to the infrastructure. So I realize that this may be more tedious than some of the previous releases and some of the other VoIP partners that are out there. But the important part here is to realize that we're trying to take you through that journey to make sure that you understand those fundamental concepts and components that are required in order to have a robust infrastructure. You know, let's think of this versus the onion security. We've all heard onion, right? Keep all that goodness in the center. Got to start thinking garlic, right? Anybody hear garlic, right? Little goodness here, a little goodness there. You get here, it doesn't really cut off the head. We can still function. So you need to start thinking garlic, not onion. Very important shift. So let's talk about some fundamental security principles here. And again, I'm sorry for those that I'm going to bore. Again, this is level 200, so I had to assume that I have people in here that don't know what security means and they think it's a key. Encryption takes cycles. As Mike referred, alluded to previously about using VPN overhead, you know, Link is, AES 128, right? Skype is 256. Does anybody know why we made one, why we picked 128 over 256 for a corporate enterprise? It's that processing requirements. It's the overhead, right? There's a trade-off. The more key, the more revolutions, the more cycle, the more processing power. When you talk about real-time communications, media, audio, there's an overhead, there's a lag, right? We have to encrypt, decrypt, process, transmit, move through. So there's a trade-off. You have to decide, you know, what's secure and what's not. But we're going to go through why AES was decided on and is a standard for, I think in the federal government here in the States, my understanding is anything that's not top secret, because we're not allowed to understand what they're using to encrypt top secret information in the States, but everything on that side of it is all AES. This is the standard. UC requires near real-time processing. Does anybody remember the days of DES and triple DES and, you know, DES, and we said, hey, why reinvent the wheel? Let's just run it three times through, and what kind of overhead that actually did for us. Again, I'm trying to tell you where the trade-offs are and that comfort zone of what security is. So AES is an encryption standard, right? It was designed with this in mind. Actually, there were five that were submitted, and there were rigorous testing, and one was selected. In 1999, DES was broken in 22 hours and 15 minutes, right? So we knew we needed to move into some other methodology and way of encrypting. So let's, quick little history lesson here. The Caesar shift, right? Or the Caesar cipher shift, or the shift cipher, depending on how you look at it. Simple concept, great idea. You know, whether we're moving 7 keys or 13 keys and we agree on it, it's a great way to communicate. There's obviously flaws in it, you know, with every language. There's common verbiage, there's common characters, you know, whether it's STI or STE, depending on your language, whether you're from Canada or from the States for some reason, we seem to see E a lot more than we see I. So, also operators, for instance, come into play, and user error helps other individuals decipher this information. So Caesar shift, first, you know, great idea. I thought I'd bring a little bit of America in here too, right? Jefferson, great idea. This was created in 1795, I think. Awesome idea. You know, it has spindles. And we define the key, the sequence of these spindles. You have them, I have them. As long as we have an agreement, we run them through. I'll encrypt, you'll decrypt, we'll get the answer. But that, how those platters were put together was the key. And we go into wartime and we think about the Enigma machine. This was a real killer for all the Allies, right? This was either a make or break kind of idea. And the Enigma machine was invented at the end of World War I and was implemented, and mostly the Germans' version of the Enigma machine was used, although there were other versions of Enigma that were utilized. And we all, as security people, know about Project Ultra and the investigation. I won't bore you guys, but this was some really neat history stuff if you're interested in learning it. That's Enigma. That's an encrypted message. I don't speak German. Wie geht's dir? Ich kann Sie Deutsch. I think I can swear a bit too for those Germans in the audience that would like to hear some, but that's as far as it goes. You always learn the swear words first in any language, right? They were able to decipher it by looking at those common characteristics in language. You know, what do we see? What are the consonants? What are the vowels? Operator error as well was one of those key reasons why it was broken down. Common language, character, patterns. It was exploited in order to decrypt it. When we think about deciphering, actually, Al-Kindi started this in the 1700s using statistical language analysis to decipher information. NAT. What's the problem with NAT, right? It stops legitimate and illegitimate traffic. It's a great concept. 1980, God bless us, IPv4, we're all freaking out, we're going to lose IPs, and we did 20 years later. But NAT, you know, was implemented in 1998, if I remember correctly. Yeah, good, I got a little pointer there, though. I didn't forget. What is it? So it masks that IP address. So, you know, we've got user A here with 192.168.200.110. I figured I'd use a pill. It seemed to make sense. We send that pill across the NAT device. It substitutes the public IP address with the private. Gets dumped off because it can't get through to the other user, right? Doesn't the internal IP address of 192.168 is not routable. We wouldn't even got across the internet, but the substitution is there. So now we think about how we do it with a published server, for instance. You know, we have a server there with an internal IP address, but we have a public IP address. I love that we've picked DNS names on port 443. Can't do any favoritism to one company or another. And it gets through, and we're able to do that establishment. And that was a great idea, but it caused some unique problems for how to get legitimate traffic beyond the firewall to the remote end party. In comes ICE Stun and Turn. What a great idea. So Stun, session transversal utilities for NAT. Turn, transversing using relays around NAT. We all know about the edge server, the two components, the access proxy, and the media edge. We'll get into a little bit more of this as we move through it. And also the aspects. So it's great that it's always on. It's internet reachable, this media relay server that we can touch and utilize and signal information through above and beyond when it's published on that NAT device, and it allows us to move into that internal corporate site. I did give a little reference here, so I think it was on Tuesday, so you have to download the deck, but if you want to get in a little bit more ICE Stun and Turn stuff, the presentation is quite good. I didn't want to touch on it too deep because most of you hopefully already attended that session. So what have we done so far? We've got the planning tools, the topology, that process, that understanding of the requirements, which are integral to deploying a secure environment. Safe, out of the box, it's locked down, it's secure. All communications are secure using certificates. Sure, you can break it. Sure, we can turn off encryption. We can throw everything out in the open, but is that necessarily what you want to do? This is why we designed Link this way, to be secure out of the box. Enterprise ready. We're using known standards like ICE Stun and Turn. We're not using some other methodologies to transverse the firewall, which may be masquerade and look like a virus. And if any of you would like to talk about that offline, I'd love to have that conversation. Perimeter NAT transversal mechanisms and server-to-server authentication using OAuth as our method for encrypting traffic. Encryption, AES, 128-bit encryption. Very important. MTLS is our method for secure transmissions between link servers, and all our real-time media is using SRTP. Mike, any comments?
I think we should go through an example where we use ICE for sure, so maybe something like the edge server?
Oh, geez, do you think he sees the slide ahead?
I do now.
So let's talk about what's on the edge. These are the key... Oh, I'll play some favorites over here now. These are the key components that are given by the edge server, right? We've got our external access. We've got that access proxy that we can utilize for registration. It's always on. It's internet accessible. We publish that out. Great component. Federation, another key component for the edge server. Do we want to allow secure transmission of link communications from point A to point B? Without stripping encryption and all the things that matter to us from an organization when we communicate from organization to organization A to organization B. XMPP, I don't actually see a whole heck of this anymore now that a certain group that said, hey, we'll go all standards and be interoperable decide to dump the idea. We'll leave that alone.
Google?
And then, pick. Public internet connectivity, right? And think of PIC, if any of you have been in the world of Link for a while, or OCS or LCS, MSN, AOL, although most of those contracts are coming end of life because most of those organizations didn't realize the potential of this, and getting most of these agreements in place still would not really happen anymore. So most of these are coming end of life. You can't even get PIC connectivity for most of these services anymore, but Skype is PIC. Anything to add?
Absolutely. So the Edge server, the main focus of Edge server, I'm sure you all know, but it's for federating all the way through. And we use ICE for that. And ICE is a five-layer component, the transaction itself, the key one being the first one. Grabs the token, and the token comes in from the media relay authentication service, and that's a role within the front end. Grabs that token, goes to the device itself, and sets that security. PKI is what we use in that case, and there are vendors throughout for that security piece.
So what is the Edge server? I went to the authoritative source on the internet. Does anybody know what the authoritative source on the internet is? Any guesses?
Nope. Wikipedia.
Wikipedia. Come on, guys. I can put the truth out there, and then you can edit it, and you can edit, and you can edit, and you can edit it, and we can all agree on the truth, right? So I say, hey, what's the Edge server? I can have it created if I wanted to. It wasn't as authoritative as I thought. So I went to my second one, TechNet. And here's what it said. The Edge server, I'm not going to read it verbatim, but basically it allows you to do communication, federation, remote access capabilities, mobility, right? These are the key components now, and mobility becoming more and more important this day in life. I don't know about you, but Link on the golf course is great, especially Link 2013, because I can do the video call, and I can get real close so they can't see the green and the flag behind me, right? My boss will listen to this. I know I'm going to get heck. So let's talk about, I needed to show some firewall ports at you. It just made sense to throw some firewall ports at you. So there's three main components of the edge. The access edge, which is the access proxy. That's that always-on, internet-accessible way for us to log in, authenticate, and gain access to resource. There's the web conferencing components, right, which proxies the web traffic for the web conferencing traffic for us. And then finally, there's that very important audio video edge component, which is giving us the audio video capabilities and allowing us to transverse the firewall and establish two-way media paths. Great, great concept. Because, you know, most organizations don't have one firewall, right? Because if it was one firewall, we could probably just hammer it at that public IP address like we do with our home routers, which is, you know, a NAT is a firewall, and it would get through to them. But most have a perimeter and an edge. That's a unique deployment requirement, and that's where the edge and the stun turn media requirements came in. So let's throw some ports at you.
Yeah.
Good? Everybody happy? That's as technical as it will get.
Just a quick add as we're going through this.
Go ahead now.
All the way through. Usually on larger deployments, and what I mean by larger deployments, over 10,000, building your DMZ and putting the Edge server in is one of the more complex issues. You got to work through your security group. You got to make sure that proper ports are enabled all the way through. And what we found in deployments on customer prem, that's time consuming, especially through your security teams all the way through. So just be aware of that, building those components into your DMZ, especially if you have a front-end DMZ and a back-end DMZ, or if you're using both ingress and egress traffic all the way through. Make sure you hit that early in the process of your deployment, because that we find deployments get
hung up,
absolutely, at that component piece itself. So just be aware of that.
I found that most, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm dealing with security individuals, they seem to be more lawyers than networking professionals. Does anybody agree with that statement? I know you do. Interesting side conversation. So let's go through the process of ICE stun and turn. And we won't go into the five-step process. We know, as Mike mentioned, there's certain MRAS, as well as our candidates are actually given to us at login. And then there's also a component that will happen with our ICE stun and turn when we do call establishment, depending on how we have to transverse the firewall. So let's walk through this very quickly. The host candidate's going to fail. Unless you're on the same infrastructure, right? You're not going to get to the host candidate again, right? This is a private IP address. Probably. unless, you know, they have no idea what security is in firewall and they've actually put their PC right on the internet. And I don't think anybody's done that for a little bit, unless you're a hacker and you just want to put a honeypot out there and entice people. That's another comment, another story. Stun candidate. So as you can see, right, we're still using that access proxy component in order to do our registration and signaling, but we're still trying to establish that media path. May work, may not, depends on the restriction of the firewall, depends on how many firewalls are between us, depends on the remote party, but more importantly, it most likely depends on the enterprise, not the Skype user, the other side behind the NAT firewall. And our final way is our turn candidate, where we'll signal and use this as our media relay component in order to transverse the firewall. Pretty simple stuff, eh? But what a great conceptual thing. Like, in my original slide, my content owner made me pull it out. I had an ice cream cone, I had a lightning bolt. This server is a godsend to us and our ability to communicate securely. I can't emphasize how important the Edge server is and how important the certificates are. Sorry to keep hammering on that. Did you know that 80% of Link deployments fail because of improper networking provisioning? We actually changed our licensing model for supportability with inside Microsoft, and that's why you'll see there's that new, well, not so new, but some of the new partners and how we actually do supportability, and the system integrator should be your level one and level two support engineer, because again, network provisioning is so important, cause is so important. We don't get into that because it's not a security concept, but very important part of any VoIP deployment is your network. And again, 80% of them deploy. You know, you'd be on the MCS, you get a phone call on Premier, and oh, this, that, and the other thing, and all of a sudden you find out they didn't program anything. They just put it on the network, and they didn't consider what it would do and how to traffic and police it, and it was a horrible experience. So work with your partner, work with your implementer and your networking people, and just understand that get the networking right off the bat. Consider the framework, the planning tool, and do your due diligence. So here's that Edge server, and this is the substitution for the ice cream cone and the lightning bolt that I was able to still put in. So it's always on, it's internet accessible, it's our ICE server, it's our SIP proxy and media relay, right? That's what the ICE server is. It's that SIP proxy for signaling, registration, all that great stuff that happens in band. Then it has our media requirements for transverse into firewall.
Yeah, a lot of deployments consider your high availability. If you really need this as a key function, federating with different customers, example, law firms really need this. So you deploy two Edge servers because your high availability. Disaster recovery comes into play. That would be two sites where you'd build that all the way through two DMCs. Just want to put it out there. That's part of the design process all the way through. Just be aware of that. High availability in federating, if you need it, whether that's Skype where you're bringing the living room to the boardroom sort of thing, or other organizations.
That was a buzz term there. He just snuck that in, real sly.
Just make sure you cover that in your design and don't be cheap about it if it's important.
Also, don't have a complete DR site sitting there never used. That's not how we design Link, right? 50-50 pool, those considerations. Very important. A lot of government organizations that I've dealt with in the past have had an actual DR site and a whole infrastructure that only got touched when the main one went down. That's not financially viable. It doesn't make sense to do it that way. So some considerations on how we've done pool pairing and those requirements with inside Link as well. I remember some conversations and the requirements for DR, very important. Recommended perimeter. A freehand tool, again, I hate Visio. I'm sorry about the black lines here, but we know that the Edge is always communicating with our pool. There's replication, right? And our reverse proxy is also talking to the front-end web services on our pool. Federated, we're coming through the Edge server, right? We're pulling that traffic. Remote users gain access using the Link services via the reverse proxy and Edge server. Mobility users are also gaining access, but we'll do this build first. External users are either registering on the Edge, right? They're getting their media, their requirements, and the reverse proxies where we're getting our web ticketing services, those types of things. If you're not familiar with that, I can give you another session that is available later on, which is great on the web token, web ticketing services that are available on that front-end server that are published as part of the reverse proxy. One key thing here, which is important, Remote users are authenticated using NTLM or TLS DSK. Does anybody know what TLS DSK is? Right, that's that certificate authentication mechanism that we're using. So you've logged in once, maybe Kerberos inside your network, hopefully. You've got a certificate. You know, we'll use that for the next, 6 months, I think, by default, something around there.
6 months, yeah.
Then we'll re-authenticate. Great way. No credentials being passed. We'll just use certificates. Certificates. If you get anything out of this session today, remember certificates.
Oh, and make sure you have an admin for the certificates to know when they expire.
Yes. Yeah. Again, if it blows up, the more obscure the warning, look at the certificates. Remote users accessing the reverse proxy will authenticate, again, using three methods, TLS, DSK, NTLM, or BASIC. NTLM is interesting, too, because, you know, again, the considerations of lockout and GPO and getting back to those foundational requirements of link. You know, most of them, three times lockout account, right? That's not necessarily a great way of dealing with it. So think we'll get and talk about some scripting capabilities in order to blacklist, do an incremental number when we're actually watching a login and lock that user out so we don't lock the account and dealing with things on the edge as well. But this is the recommended deployment. Director server. So not a recommended deployment, but sometimes a requirement for the organizations that we're dealing with, where they don't want authentication to happen to the front-end server. They want that quasi-proxy to authenticate before we actually hit those back-end services. That's a requirement. That's the use case where you use a director. Also, if we have multi-forest design, a director will allow us to do authentication lookups quicker and remove the load from the front-end servers. So very geographically dispersed, forest domains, lots of goodness, lots of pools. Directors actually help us as well with the load on our front-end servers. Administrative overhead, it's another piece, another VM, another thing to patch, more surface area, hardware overhead. It's not a recommended deployment, but required depending on those use cases of your clients. And there is a slight delay because there's a redirection that occurs at the proxy, at that director proxy. Now, this is my favorite one. This is the one I see more often than not, especially when people are moving from other versions of VoIP, where they want to jam everything through a VPN because for some reason they think, if it's over a VPN, it's more secure, damn it. I'm not going end-to-end over the internet. There's so much overhead as well, right? Signaling and in-band signaling and proxying and login, not a big deal. But when we start talking about the real-time processing requirements, that overhead can kill you. Again, I know I mentioned that comment of how many people have made a phone call over a VPN. Was it a great experience? No? A lot of latency? Yeah? Wasn't great. A lot of overhead. So definitely something to look at. Split tunneling. I'll just build this out so I can talk to it. Split tunneling is important here. So if the VPN is a requirement of the organization and they're saying, hey, I want that authentication for whatever reason, I need this to happen, these types of things to occur, that's fine, but make sure that you have the VPN properly set up. We've got split tunneling enabled. We're putting media through one way and we're putting other things the other way. Let's not try to jam the media through the VPN. This is not the right way to deploy it. You're going to have a lot of overhead. It is no more secure, right? Because we're using certificates, we're using AES encryption, and most VPNs are using AES encryption. So, you know, what's the difference between the two? There seems to be this misunderstanding or this preconception that a VPN is more secure, but there's overhead, there's processing requirements, there's another client.
The other issue, too, and our competitors use this, we're not saying the word, but they're the other major UC player, is there's a bottleneck. It comes in one source. So depending on that process speed of that, if it's an older VPN, you're going to slow down your calls tremendously.
No, Mike, you just buy more hardware. Right? Just buy more hardware, more hardware. Yeah. Internet of everything, buy more hardware, more hardware, more hardware. It's a great scaling model,
We always see that. The competitors sell the UC product first, and then, oh, by the way, you've got to upgrade your network, and it's hundreds of thousands of dollars. How many times have we seen that?
But the client's free. The client's free, right?
Yep.
It's all about smoke and mirrors. And if any of you actually understood that statement, you probably laughed. reverse proxy considerations and options. So the reverse proxy, a nice little spinning slide here. Here's the great thing that it is. Let's put a circle around it too. What does it do for us? Meeting content, address book, web app, location information services, mobility and auto discover. Key components there, right? So you can deploy Link without a reverse proxy. It's not, you know, bar one requirement, but you have to understand that there are some trade-offs, right? If I have an edge up, I can still log in remotely. I can still connect. I'm just missing a lot of stuff. But I can have a phone call. Maybe that's good enough. Maybe you don't need mobility. Maybe you don't need this stuff. Again, depending on the client requirement, the surface area attack, that security feeling, you can deploy it, you cannot. But typically, 99% of deployments with Link would use a reverse proxy because BYOD, right? It's a big piece.
Yeah. Reverse proxy, very simple concept. IP address comes in, uses NAT and PAT, for those that are a little more technical here, to get to the proper server and roles on our side of the list that you see there all the way through. Very, very important. Does anyone know what the leading reverse proxy vendor out there is as part of our ecosystem? Anyone know? F5 we see quite a bit of the time, and I think we'll talk about that later.
Yep.
Go ahead.
So what is a reverse proxy? I tried to, you know, again, take all these great authoritative sources and bake it down to a simple idea. It's a way of publishing internal resources externally securely, right? And there's different flavors of reverse proxy capabilities. You know, we can look at relational capabilities in order to parse and, you know, make sure that only certain data is coming through if we see certain values and dealing with it securely. And there's different implementations of that as well. So again, what's a reverse proxy? I went to Wikipedia. It actually had a statement on what a reverse proxy is. I won't get into it. And then the configuration requirements, this I'd like to call out because this is great. This is from TechNet. What's the requirement for a reverse proxy? Link 2013 does not specify a particular reverse proxy that you must use. Link Server 2013 only defines operational requirements that a reverse proxy must be able to do. Typically, the reverse proxy that you already have deployed in your infrastructure will be able to meet those needs. That's a great statement. So what's supported? Technically, in Link 2013, there are three, as it stands right now. There's F5, as my colleague mentioned. This is what we see more often than not in the EPG space and scaling capabilities, especially LTM when we're looking at multi-data center paths, up, down, all that great hardware. Oh, I love F5. They do some really neat stuff. Then there's also ARR, because we end-of-life TMG, right? That was still feeling a little pain around that. Great, does reverse proxy. We can publish certain things up, take a request, forward it through. There is some relational expression capabilities that we can look for in leveraging. And then finally, TMG that's there. So TMG, and I did want to call this out. We ceased licensing TMG in November 2012. Mainstream support finishes April 14th, 2015. Extended support for TMG goes till April 14th, 2020. So if you have TMG there, you're good for a little while, but yeah, start considering some other capability and requirements.
Just to add, the list here is really our main ones that we have done certification with all the way through. There is a really great vendor out, software-wise. You can put this on any server. It's Kemp, and they're actually on our floor today. And they'll talk about the reverse proxy and load balancing solution, which is really, really a good starting point. F5 is pretty expensive as a device.
19,000 MSRP Canadian entry level.
Yeah, it's expensive. And they own the market share, certainly. But Kemp, I've used the product, and I've seen hundreds of deployments using them. So get familiar with that company. And I'm really glad to see them at this session. I think that they're great value.
But we're not apples and apples either, right?
Yeah, question over here.
Let's make sure we call that out. Sorry? Was that, I think that was made public, wasn't it? Yeah, UAG.
Yes,
I think that was made public, right?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Same as TMG. Right? Because UAG is an overlay to TMG. It's an inbound proxy control overlay. If you've deployed UAG, you saw the TMG console in the start menu. If one's dead, the other one's dead, probably. That makes a lot of sense, does it not? So, yeah, unfortunately, Unified Access Gateway for inbound granular authentication and authorization was also end of life. I think it was end of life, though, after TMG, so extended support and mainstream support will be a little bit longer. Yep. Agreed, because TMG was the only one. UAG was kind of like our web publishing portal for applications. It was not meant as a reverse proxy. It does reverse proxy capabilities, but you couldn't go through the UAG console and actually publish. You could, but you had to get into TMG and do things that you shouldn't have done and were not necessarily supported. And if you called for support, you would have a lot of pain, and they would tell you to pull that out in order to really find out what's going on. It was never listed as part of the certified, right? And also, I believe Mike Kemp is listed under Link 2010 as a certified reverse proxy. These are 2013 currently tested products, but there are quite a few that are being tested. Microsoft doesn't test these. We use a third party to test them as well.
And they just haven't gone through that process, but there is hundreds of deployments with them, and I see it as an easy config tool at a good price point. Quick question over here. Go.
Got to be quick because I'm running out of time.
Yep.
Coming to it. Hold on just a sec.
Yep.
So I got 15 minutes here. Let me kind of ramp a bit here, and I'd love to have the conversation and questions at the end.
Yep.
So IaaS with application routing request, or AR. You know, internal, external, NIC on both sides. We can publish lots of great stuff on it. Server 2012 standard or higher is great on it. WAX server, we can publish exchange infrastructure. It has a way of parsing with relational. We can even look for certain, you know, dial in, meet, and actually have a layer of security there. Web application proxy server, 2012 R2, my friend. There's actually a blog posting here where you can download the article. We've done, the gentleman did a whole walkthrough on how to publish it. One pullout, though, is the SNI requirement there. You need a default certificate for the WAP. So when you build out the application proxy, there's a little bit of PowerShell you have to do, find out the fingerprint or the thumbprint for what you're using as a certificate, and then put that in as a default as well for the SNI to work properly. I've asked that, and I couldn't get an answer in time. Right? So the answer to me was, I won't go back four slides, but this is what we require for a reverse proxy. So when we think about F5 and LTM as a reverse proxy, this is really great. If you've looked at the IAP, it actually asks you very simple questions and produces a fairly optimized flow routine through the F5. Again, you know, you're paying for some great goodness in this device. If your organization can afford it and require it, this is a great way of utilizing it because it's not just a reverse proxy. It does a whole bunch of other things, which we're going to get into in just a moment. I wanted to touch quickly on two-factor authentication.
One of the quick introductions, this is one of the myths from our competitors is we don't do it. Simply not true. We're just going to talk about this, and I'll talk about where the future goes after this. Go ahead.
So there's two stages of authentication, right? Two-step verification. You know, and I've called out some common things here, the FUD, the password, the smart card, the password, you know, Windows Live Services and the new authentication app that you can get on your phones and it does a PIN and you no longer have to log in with your password. It's a great idea. But, you know, what about something that you are? And we're really going this way, right? The biometric, something you are rather than a password, a finger and an eyeball. A lot harder to copy than a smart card and a password, right? And we're going to see, I think, from a security, if any of you have been in data centers or if you had an opportunity of going to one of our Office 365 data centers, I went in once and I lost 3 pounds. Don't lose any weight when you go to a data center. I got locked in that trap box, alarms going off, the guy came down, he swore I wasn't who I was because I was 3 pounds lighter. So it's not so much about the what or the how, it's more about you And I think you're seeing a transition in that way. Kind of freaks me out a little bit. I hope I don't ever have somebody come with shears and take my thumb off my hand because, you know, that's my password, right? That's where we're headed. So, you know, not to go so 1984-ish, but conceptually, that's an interesting idea, right? We've all watched Star Trek and all these great TV shows, but we're definitely there.
Yeah, and you're going to see that more and more. You're starting to see that on the Apple platform itself in terms of the resolution with your eyes. Going forward, DNA is going to become an authentication within our lifespan. It's not here yet, next 15 years, where they do a DNA scan for you to enter into secure areas. We're going to see that, certainly.
Gattaca, remember? You put your finger down, they took the blood. That was great. So I just wanted to call out somewhere where we've implemented Windows Live Services. So again, the authentication app, right? You log into Outlook.com. We go to security. We want to turn on our phone factor before we rebranded the name, for those that remember that acquisition that we made, and are calling it our Windows Live Service Authenticator app, two-factor authentication or authorization. So you can turn this on. You download the Authenticator app. We install it. You open it. There's a little barcode. I definitely wasn't going to show you my barcode because that gives you my password, right? Shh. Then it's turned on. You know, what do you need to do? You enter a code. I have a code here and actually can change too, which is kind of freaky. And I can recover that. And now all of a sudden, that's what I'm using to log in and do that two-step authorization and authentication now. And we're moving that way because just a password isn't necessarily good enough anymore. You know, or a token and a FUB. Great device to utilize, right? Everybody's got a phone, so why not start utilizing some of this technology in order to do two-factor authentication, which we baked into Link. There's capabilities. I do have some reference URLs later in the deck where you can look at leveraging two-factor authentication inside Link with maybe a security FUB or those types of things. Now, this is where I want to really get. Securing beyond Link. So I hope to point, we've talked and said Link's secure out of the box. We encrypt everything. You can break it and decrypt it, but why would you do that? Certificates are king, and the edge server is the greatest gift from God. If anything you've gotten, those are the statements that I would make to this point. So now beyond Link. Now we have this branch office here connecting to our SBC, maybe IPPPX, some other legacy device that we're utilizing here. We have our actually supported SIP trunking provider here. You don't trunk right to Link, do you guys? Good, I'm glad nobody raised their hand. And then we've got other connections, maybe an unsupported, maybe a UDP-type connection. Maybe we're using transcoding in a gateway. We had an existing telco relationship, and they didn't support TCP handshake, so we had to use an intermediate way of connecting. SBC was a great way of doing that. Gateway device, maybe you had a MPLS network inside and you weren't going over the internet, but this is more common from what we see. But we get our denial of service, we get our theft of service, and we get breach of security. Any SBC should be securing you from those three risks.
Yep. In the telco space, they're offering services where their endpoint is an SBC, mainly because of security. Also, two, secondary, troubleshooting. That's the trend that we're seeing.
Yeah. And again, gunning to our competitor, a lot of, you know, let's just punch a hole through the firewall and let the two things talk to each other. Yeah. I would never trunk my front-end server directly to a provider. I wouldn't do that. I'd use an SBC as an intermediate point because it gives me benefits. I can authenticate. I can have a username and a password. I can lock down by IP address, ports, those types of things. But I can take it that step further and secure it. So, should protect you against minute call theft. Interestingly enough, default to PSTN for those people that have PRIs. Most people, you know, in firewalls, that last rule is deny any. Most people don't look at those routing tables inside the gateways or session border controllers or what's controlling their PRIs. Minute and service theft, more often than not, happen here. Actually, I think the first term hacking was used at MIT when they started blasting the PBXs back in the day. And then we freaking and these other types of things. So very important. Anybody remember the Captain Crunch whistle? I'm probably, again, dating myself, so I'm looking at the people that look as gray as I am in the audience. That Captain Crunch whistle produced 2,600 hertz frequency. So I could pick up the phone and call a trunk operator, knock the operator off the trunk and take over. That was awesome. You know, obviously things have changed drastically since then, and we're not all 18 anymore, but some great ideas. So protect, understand some of these requirements, very important. SBCs, look at the firewall, the blacklisting capabilities, those intrusion protection systems that should happen on layer 3 and layer 4. Lock down access. I'm surprised, again, you know, people who poured out trunking, even if you were to trunk directly from the front-end server, how many people are actually locking down the communications at their firewall to say, this port, this IP, that's it? Surprisingly enough, it doesn't happen as often as you would think. What a great way to steal service. I know the ports, right? Probably 5061, if I'm lucky. I'm going to come in and hammer you, and I'm going to steal some service. Because people aren't doing those steps beyond link to secure the infrastructure. Very important. Every SBC that you're connecting to from your telco is a public IP address. Lock it down. Pick an unused port. Get off of 5061. Think of other ways of securing it. You know, use SRTP as your method for securing between the two. Also consider using an SBC, which you can authenticate to those trunking providers as well, and have additional layers of security depending on your security requirements as an organization. So I just want to call out F5 here, not just a firewall. Does some great stuff with load balancer, has a great denial of service protection, URL validation as well, all configured as part of the IAP. So when we think about securing beyond link, this was something that I was talking with a few gentlemen at the back here. When we think about the information we federate, for instance, unfortunately, I couldn't get the IAP built in time to present it, but I was conceptually allowed to talk about this and got the release from F5 to say, hey, we can do this. F5 does this now with PCL compliance with credit cards that transverse the firewall. They look for pattern recognition, they see it's a credit card, they knock it out and put X's in. Why not use that in link? there's headers, there's definite ways that we can understand the data that's being transmitted and classify it and then do substitution or removal. For instance, my contact card, right? What type of information am I sharing? Am I sharing the DID to a remote organization? Maybe I don't want you to have my DID that calls me directly. Maybe I want to substitute that out and put in the corporate 800 number, which is for everybody, right, as a conceptual idea. So you can do this with F5. We allow you to do it because F5 encrypts and decrypts there. It has the certificates on it. It has the key and the cert. It does deep inspection. You can use the IAP and the URL content filtering capabilities with inside the IAP to look for pattern recognition and substitute it out. So now I'm thinking, beyond link, what type of information do you want to share with those remote organizations? Does it have to be an all or nothing ordeal? It doesn't necessarily need to be. Although link is all or nothing, there are ways that we can reach to our ecosystem in order to secure and decide how much or how little we share with certain organizations. Yeah, there's 16 housekeeping slides here, Mike. It's actually not that bad. So I wanted to call out Skype here because we obviously there's a, you know, security is not just security, could be compliance, archiving, and those types of things. So we all know Skype. Silk is the method that we use for audio right now in V1, although, you know, you all heard about V2 and the video capabilities. I'm not going to get into that stuff yet. You can talk to Barry and Derek about that if you'd like to. But our partners have now implemented Silk recording capabilities as well. So if you have PIC internet connectivity and you have compliance and archiving requirements, if Link's calling Skype, that can also be recorded if it's with inside the organization. So you have those other capabilities at your disposal in order to meet your regulatory security compliance requirements. This was my favorite one, but we'll skip. I have to let it build, unfortunately. It doesn't let me... Anybody know what denial of service is? Or distributed denial of service, right? It's hammered out. Somebody launches that Obamacare website, I think, right? And everybody hits it once. Isn't it $126 million that young lady has racked up so far billing to Obamacare website? And yet it's just a... Anyway, another story. So, let's look at how AudioCodes deals with it, because I wanted to call out AudioCodes and Sonos as two of our big partners. So we go layer 3 and layer 4. We have rate limiting and filtering capabilities in there in order to reduce the overhead to our backend infrastructure, therefore stopping our critical systems inside the organization going down from a distributed service attack on the internet. Overcome TCP vulnerabilities using TLS authentication. Filtering oversized messages because, you know, as things read it, it's got to read that whole string message, you know, like FTP, for instance. We can go oversize before we decide whether it's garbage. That's a lot of overhead. That's a lot of processing. Let's remove that from the back-end infrastructures that we require as an organization to be operational and put them on those security devices in the edge. Filtering out SIP messages that don't have the right dialogue requirements. Accept messages based on SIP header properties. We see this a lot when we have SBC or organizations. Why not substitute a name into the in-band messaging? And then we'll look for that name on the other side. That is actually a very secure way of doing information exchange. Put something into the message that nobody else would know is in there except the organization. And then on the remote side, look for it, and if it isn't there, dump it. Right? Securing beyond link. We look at Sonos. They also have some great stuff at the packet layer as well. I wanted to call them out. I don't want to be favoritism to one or the other. Great products, both of them. They all have trade-off. This is just packet layer capabilities with Sonos, although there is application layers as well. If you'd like to see that, I can share that.
Yeah. We didn't get Acme. Acme is the third major vendor. We didn't get their security in time, so we couldn't present it here today, but certainly want to recognize that they have a large market share in the SBC space.
Great stuff. Acme's great. So let's just quickly cover what we covered. Love these types of things. You just basically copy the first slide at the end and say, hey, this is what we talked about. So link security and considerations. Link is secure out of the box. It can be challenging. There's a lot of upfront requirements, but if you do your due diligence and follow process, it'll be a great experience for everybody that utilizes the product. Covered some basic security principles. Yes, I'm sorry, I talked about NAT and PAT and those types of things. I probably bored the hell out of everybody. We talked about the edge server, which is a key component for those remote requirements in BYOD. Some common deployments, reverse proxy, and then utilizing appliances beyond link to secure across the boundaries. That's it.
Great.
Questions?
Go ahead.
Well, we're starting to see a lot of more application-based firewalls.
Mm-hmm.
Just typical ways. So, for example, Palo Alto's. Palo Alto's, right, ASAs are now, you know, the next-gen ASAs are going to have application-based firewalls in them. I was an intern client that had deployed their own link environment at Palo Alto's, and they had that entire thing open. Why? Because they couldn't figure out how to open the ports and the application level rules to ensure that the link edge would work. So, I'm sure you've probably heard of this too, but that's a huge thing we're seeing in the past. I know you guys have the OIP for all the certification requirements. It almost seems like it would be a benefit to the link world and the community if you guys start working with some of those vendors that have those application-based firewalls to ensure that they have the proper documentation on how to make their application-based firewalls to work properly with all the ports and protocols that we use.
Here, I agree. So, you know, the question... I always have to repeat the question. You know, when we look at these application firewalls and some of the more complexity and, you know, machine logic applications that are occurring as well when we consider some of the requirements, traditionally Microsoft doesn't go out and ask, right? It's people that want to come, do the certification, because we don't do the certifications. Everything's done through third party so that it's hands off. We don't, you know, there's no smoke and mirrors. It's very... You know, they said it worked. We didn't say it worked. They did the testing. This was their requirement. This is what they did. But I feel your pain.
Yeah.
I have dumped into Message Analyzer or Wireshark or whatever you want more than I would necessarily want in some complex environments.
Yeah.
Another one that I have a lot of challenges with is Juniper and how it does 5061 in TLS. You know, I've pulled my hair out in some very simplistic scenarios that, my God, what was it thinking? And, you know, it's in the end, it's, you know, this rule should have been above this one. Something's very odd when you look at it, because 5061 and SIP, it's a defined standard. Why can't A look at it the same way as B and C? You know, and again, there's, we get back to that whole idea of fragmentation as well, right? It's a challenge. I agree. You know, that's why.
Agree.
But it almost has to go this way too, right? Because the when you look at security and you know Mark Rusinovich, anybody read his books? It's one of the. I love reading a book where I can read it and it's not BS. You know, it's actually applied concept that could be real. It's getting tough out there, and the exploits and the vulnerabilities are not just what we would have considered script kiddies 10 years ago, right? They're getting more complex. You know, we saw the nuclear PCIL chip, right? And specific codes, specific countries, specific requirement. That wasn't a script kiddie that wrote that, right? We're seeing more in Canada, for instance, right? During the potash deal in Alberta, this is public knowledge, Treasury Board Services got hacked by another country during that negotiation in order to uncover additional information that would have benefited that purchase. So it's no longer just, you know, people seeing if they can do it. There's that financial reward, that incentive, and it's kind of going beyond other things. It's a challenge, I agree.
Just to add to that too, I think it's a great suggestion because what we're starting to see trend-wise, Link is here to stay. There's no doubt. Our traction's huge. But Link is going to become the platform. And on that platform, we're starting to see this, there's applications hanging off of it. Example, Context Center, really hot application.
LRS,
absolutely,
right.
Another one. And we're starting to see that. And more, those apps, think of Context Center. You have workforce management, you have multi-recorded sessions, right? Financial districts all the way through. That complexity is going to demand the application layer firewalls all the way through. So I think that OWASP will definitely grow all the way through. It's a certification process that they have to go through. I mentioned CAMP. CAMP works, but they're just not OWASP certified. So we just have to make sure that those companies get certified and they join our ecosystem all the way through.
I wish there was an easier answer. It's something that we both deal with every
day. Any other questions?
Firewall. Load balancer.
Yes.
No.
It's a separate testing mechanism.
Testing, completely.
Yeah, we go through that, and so they'd have to, probably the reason why is there's a payment that they have to make for the OIP. They probably didn't go through it twice. That's, yeah. But they're here, and feel free to talk to them. Great product on the lower end.
From my understanding, they are going through the process, though.
Yeah, that's right? a good point, too.
Actually, there's quite a few that are in that process right now. Pretty neat stuff coming in there.
I think in future we need a session on OWASP and our OWASP because it's it gets complex. Are there questions? There's a question at the back.
Everything. So on my load balancer, it's my reverse proxy. The IAP will actually allow me to do more than just my edge devices as well. And I can use a single big IP appliance to not only load balance my edge array, but my front-end pools as well, or my directors. So really, when we look at that concept of the substitution, all that traffic can go through there. It can't just be reverse proxy, because that's not where Federation traffic transverses, not the reverse proxy. Federation goes through the edge.
Okay.
You'd be surprised. F5, from my streaming and what I've been put through, sizing is important. That gets back to networking as well, right? If you're not network, you know, if you've got a 100 meg connection across there, are you doing HD video either? Probably not. You know, link room system, when we consider initial benchmarking, requires 8 to 10 meg sustain rate. You need to have the right provisioning capabilities in order to take advantage of it. Great. I hope you enjoyed the session, guys. I know we're way over. If you want a puck, come grab some hardware.
I'd recommend it.